Good evening. I'm William Brangham. Jeff Bennett and Amna Nawaz are away. On the NewsHour tonight, President Biden works to sell the climate aspects of the Inflation Reduction Act to voters a year after it became law. Minnesota Representative Dean Phillips calls for a potential primary challenge against President Biden, as many Democrats remain skeptical about his re-election. And we examine the current state in Egypt, a decade after the massacre of hundreds of people protesting a military coup.
It was basically not just the end of the promise of the Egyptian revolution of 2011, but really the end of our country as we know it.
Good evening and welcome to the NewsHour. Survivors on Maui spent another day picking up the pieces more than a week after wildfires devastated parts of the island. The confirmed death toll now stands at 111 people, even as rescue crews work to find more of the missing. Donation centers have been set up to distribute food, clothing, and other essential supplies, and to offer encouragement in the wake of such devastating loss.
You know, people are telling us, get out of here. The air is not good. The water is not good. It's like, but people that lost their cars, people that lost everything and are living in neighbors' houses or whatever, we need to be close to them so they can come and get supplies.
Crews have searched roughly 40% of the disaster area so far. Hawaii's governor estimates that over 1,000 people are still unaccounted for. Wildfires have also burned a widespread area in Canada's Northwest Territories. A mass evacuation is underway in Yellowknife, the region's capital city and home to some 20,000 people, as a blaze burns about 10 miles away. Residents sped past burnt forests and heavy plumes of smoke as they fled from the fire's path. The city's mayor warned that the window to evacuate safely is shrinking.
There is a possibility that without rain, the fire reaches the outskirts of Yellowknife by the weekend. It is approaching, but there's time to complete the community evacuation. It's being called now so that we can allow people the opportunity to drive while the highway is open. Conditions will be smoky, and residents should drive with caution and care.
More than 200 active wildfires are burning in the Northwest Territories and over 1,000 across all of Canada. Monsoon rains have pummeled northern India for days now as residents scramble for safety from the resulting floods and landslides. At least 72 people have died. In Shimla, video captured the moment an entire section of cliff broke off and toppled down a mountainside, taking several homes with it. Crews have rescued over 2,000 people by digging through the Himalayan terrain or airlifting people from the floodwaters. In Pakistan, authorities have arrested more than 100 Muslims following a round of attacks on Christian churches and homes. A mob stormed the town of Jaranwala overnight, angered by an alleged desecration of a Quran. Most Christian residents were able to escape, but they returned to find their property vandalized and destroyed. Police patrolled the streets to try and prevent more violence.
Look at our houses, look at our churches, look at our street. If someone did wrong, arrest them. Why are our houses and churches being burned? It was one person's mistake, and they burned all the churches in Jaranwala. Why did they destroy these poor people's homes? Where will they stay? They lost everything.
No casualties were reported. Christians make up about 2% of Pakistan's population. More than 60 people are feared dead after a ship carrying mostly Senegalese migrants capsized in the Atlantic Ocean. Rescuers searched the waters near the island of Cape Verde off West Africa. They've rescued dozens, but more than 50 others are still missing. The boat left Senegal last week, carrying about 100 people en route to Spain. In economic news, U.S. mortgage rates have hit their highest levels in more than 20 years. Mortgage buyer Freddie Mac said that the average long-term rate climbed to more than 7% this week. That's up from 5% a year ago. And on Wall Street, stocks fell for a third straight day. The Dow Jones Industrial Average shed 291 points to close at 34,475. The Nasdaq lost 158 points. the S&P 500 slipped 34. Still to come on the News Hour, diplomat Rahm Emanuel discusses a critical upcoming summit with the U.S., South Korea, and Japan. Pulitzer Prize-winning author Ann Patchett discusses her new book, Tom Lake. We highlight the often overlooked career of the woman known as the First Lady of Physics, plus much more.
This is the PBS NewsHour from WETA Studios in Washington and in the West from the Walter Cronkite School of Journalism at Arizona State University.
It has been 1 year since President Biden signed the Inflation Reduction Act. Despite its title, this law is the single biggest U.S. investment in addressing climate change and driving a transition to clean energy. It steers billions in subsidies into everything from battery manufacturing to climate adaptation. It contains tax incentives for people to buy electric cars and cleaner technologies in their homes. And it directs large investments to fight pollution in underserved communities. So how is the law working? And what does it mean for the U.S.'s climate commitments? We are joined by one of the law's most ardent champions. Leah Stokes is a political scientist at UC Santa Barbara who studies and advocates for clean energy. Leah Stokes, so good to have you back on the NewsHour. I wonder if you could just reflect on this anniversary at first. I mean, after decades of disappointment and setbacks, the environmental and climate community got a piece of legislation like this pushed over the finish line with a president that nobody immediately thought was going to be an ally in that fight. How is the community feeling on this week, this anniversary?
Well, you know, getting any climate bill into law onto President Biden's desk, it was brutal. It took, in some count, weeks, other counts, months, maybe years, and as you said, decades. It was really hard, and this particular law stopped and started numerous times. I'll tell you, there was a two-week period before it came out of nowhere, being branded the Inflation Reduction Act, where we all thought the bill was dead for real this time. And there was real sadness across the climate community because folks knew this was really the last best chance that we had to pass a climate law. So seeing President Biden sign it a year ago, I mean, it was just monumental.
And what is it about the law? I touched on some of the things that it does, but there is a myriad set of incentives and subsidies here. What stands out most to you?
Well, the law is massive. You know, sometimes people will say it's $370 billion, but that's not really true because huge parts of the law are uncapped tax credits, meaning the more people decide to build factories in the United States and take advantage of incentives, the more the federal government will step up and help cost share. And that isn't just for factories and companies, it's also for everyday people. So if people decide to get an electric vehicle or put in a heat pump, put solar on their roof, the federal government is going to help share the costs. And that's as big as people make it. So this is huge. And it also includes $50 billion of rebates, direct payments that are going to flow largely to disadvantaged communities to help folks from all across the income spectrum get advantage of those clean energy technologies.
And how do we know how the law is working so far?
Well, you know, there are parts of the law like the tax credits that are already going out the door. And so we can see, you know, upwards of $275 billion of private investments in everything from, you know, manufacturing batteries in the United States to recycling those batteries to solar projects to wind projects and wind manufacturing. I mean, we have seen something like 175,000 new announced jobs. And that's just on the corporate side. You know, for everyday people, we're seeing electric vehicle adoption like we've never seen before. One in four cars sold in California right now is an electric vehicle. If you look year over year, we've had a 74% jump in electric vehicle sales. You know, same thing with solar panels. They're just flying off the shelf. So we're really starting to see that happen. Now, there are parts of the law where the money hasn't gotten out the door yet. And that's largely that money that I talked about, the $50 billion for disadvantaged communities.
You're a political scientist, and so I want to ask you a politics question here. One view of the IRA is that its political genius was steering billions of dollars for green energy into red states. I want to put this chart up. This shows how investments are flowing heavily to Republican districts compared to Democratic districts. How is that playing out?
part of the reason for that is that there are provisions in this law that steer money towards former fossil fuel communities, you know, coal communities that have lost a lot of jobs and investment. Why don't we try to build manufacturing there? Why don't we try to put solar projects and wind projects in those kinds of communities? That's what the law is doing.
And there have been some pockets of resistance to this. We've seen some states push back and say, I don't want this federal money. Others, we've seen local officials championing the projects that the money has delivered while they actually had voted against the law. Do you think this, in the end, will help convert the climate skeptics out there?
Absolutely. You know, for too long, the fossil fuel industry has had a stranglehold over the Republican Party. When you have so much campaign contributions flowing into one party, that really skews things, right? So when we have clean energy technologies in Republican districts, that's going to shift things in the other direction.
One of the critiques of this law is that it is incredibly expensive and it is federal meddling in energy policy. And the argument being, if these technologies are going to live on their own, they should just live on their own in the marketplace. And there was evidence before the IRA was passed that wind and solar prices were plummeting. And so they argue, don't let the market be contaminated by sacks of federal dollars. What do you make of that argument?
I mean, fossil fuels have had federal subsidies for over a century. Year after year, they take in more than $20 billion of federal subsidies, and those continue to this day. So it's not like the fossil fuel industry or the energy industry more broadly doesn't have subsidies. And let's look at the cost of inaction on climate change. Look at what is happening in Maui and Lahaina. Entire communities are being devastated. We've had 200 million Americans under extreme heat in the last few months. We've had hundreds of millions of Americans experience these wildfires. I mean, the cost of inaction is so much bigger than investing in clean energy technologies here in the United States. And I think over the long run, a lot of these Republican skeptics, they're going to start to see jobs in their district, investments, and I think they're going to come along with the clean energy technologies of the 21st century.
Leah Stokes of UC Santa Barbara, thank you so much for being here.
Thanks so much for having me on.
The crowded but static GOP presidential primary has dominated national attention this summer. But on the Democratic side, President Biden has largely avoided any serious primary challengers. The president has served in federal government for more than 40 years. And while the majority of his party is behind him, some are calling for a change. White House correspondent Laura Barrón-López has more.
Dean Phillips is a third-term Democratic congressman from Minnesota, and he thinks President Biden should not seek re-election. Phillips wants the president to pass the torch, but so far, none of the big names in his party want to pick it up. Congressman Phillips joins me now. Congressman, thank you so much for joining the NewsHour. President Biden is the oldest sitting president in history, but you've said this isn't about age. So what is this about?
Well, and let me start by complimenting him. I think President Biden is a remarkable man, a man who saved our country, certainly the best man for the job in the last 4 years, a man I honor, a man of integrity and competency and decency. And that's not the issue. You know, Laura, I come from the private sector. I use data to drive decisions. I use listening to inform my decisions. And then I use instinct to help make those decisions. So as I look at the data, as I listen, I believe I'm simply giving voice to what an overwhelming majority of the country feels right now. It's not about the past. His policies are extraordinary, by the way. I voted for every one of them, and I helped market them. I believe in him. But I also believe in what I read, what I see, and what I'm feeling. And my job is to represent. And I believe that Democrats should have a thoughtful conversation now, before the primaries really begin. We already have a competitive primary, Robert F. Kennedy and Marianne Williamson in the race already. We already have Cornel West running as a third-party candidate. I simply want to see Cornel West enter the primary. If Joe Manchin wants to run, enter the primary. I believe Democrats do better when we have choices, freedom to choose. And the data right now is making me very concerned. And Laura, I'll just wrap with this. I woke up the morning after the 2016 election. I was living a wonderful life. My daughters, 16 and 18 at that time, woke up the next morning and were in tears. I saw fear in their eyes for the first time. I promised them I would do something, and I ran for Congress. Five years later, I'm not going to sit still and be quiet while we have that risk of him coming back, and I want to make sure that we're best prepared with the best candidates to take on.
Congressman, on that note, though, your fellow Democrats have argued that your efforts to seek out a primary challenger for against President Biden could actually weaken his reelection bid and could very well put the former President Trump back in the White House. So what do you say to their concerns about that?
Well, I think that's just patently untrue. And I first of all, my call is for the president to pass the torch. I think that would be in the country's best interest and certainly Democrats. We have an extraordinary bench of Democrats ready to go, prepared, proximate, well-positioned, but we'll never know that. And I don't want to wait 5 years. Many people are telling me that, and the data is also. And I understand we are people of different perspectives, sometimes different motives. Mine is very pure in this. This is not about me. It's not about me running for president. It is about me trying to elevate a conversation that right now is surprising that nobody wants to have. And I do not want a repeat of 2016 when we essentially anointed someone. It was her turn. And lo and behold, look what happened. I think we're sleepwalking into the very same mistake again. And the time to have the conversation, Laura, is right now.
Congressman, some of your own Minnesota Democrats, like your own governor, Tim Walz, has said that you should stay in your own lane. Ken Martin, the chair of your state's Democratic Party, has called this effort disappointing and that you're repeating baseless Republican talking points. Have you talked to voters in your state, but also battleground states, about this push?
Yes, and I'm so glad you bring that up. Let's talk about battleground states. I don't care about the national data. Joe Biden won by 7 million votes nationally last time. He would do so again. I'm worried about the 5 or 6 swing states, the battlegrounds that are the most consequential. That's why I've called for some of the moderate governors, people representing those very states that have great organization, great influence, and great capability to consider entering as alternatives because they can perform well. Yes, voters, to answer your question very directly, people all around the country are reaching out to me. And let me assure you, if they're reaching out to me, they're reaching out to every single one of my colleagues asking for the same thing. They want choices. The data is really clear.
Those moderate governors, though, that you've mentioned, whether it's Gretchen Whitmer of Michigan, mm-hmm. even Tim Walz of Minnesota, have said that they aren't interested in running against a former president and they support him. The president actually in 2020 outperformed you in your own district by roughly 3 points. Mm-hmm. And you've said you're considering challenging him yourself if no one else steps up. So what would your strategy be to beat him?
It's not about me, and I don't anticipate doing that because I believe there are people, as you just referenced. I'm not well positioned for this. I am well positioned as the only voice calling attention to something that we should be talking about. Think about Governor Whitmer and Senator Warnock from Michigan and Georgia, a pastor from the South, a man of color, a woman at the top of the ticket in a year in which reproductive rights will probably be front and center more than any other policy issue. And they're next generation exciting candidates that could activate, energize the Democratic base and get us excited. You know, I'm looking at this as hopeful, optimistic, exciting, and I'm afraid that we are sleepwalking into the very circumstance of 2016. This is not about me. I'm using this 15 minutes, I'm using this opportunity with you tonight to simply ask people to give it a little thought. Look at the numbers. Don't listen to me. Look at the numbers. Talk to friends. Mm-hmm. Are other people feeling the same? That's what I'm trying to do. I wish this would not be about me. I'm trying to do a service to Democrats, but most importantly, to a country that really, really needs it.
Congressman Dean Phillips of Minnesota, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you so much.
Tomorrow, President Biden will host a summit at Camp David with the leaders of Japan and South Korea, two nations with a long, complicated history. But they, along with the United States, share common goals, curbing China's influence in the region and addressing threats from North Korea. Tomorrow's summit will deal with military cooperation, the sharing of intelligence, and technology development. Joining us for more on the goals of this summit is Rahm Emanuel, the U.S. ambassador to Japan. Ambassador, very good to have you on the NewsHour. This is the first Camp David summit of the Biden administration. Can you give us a sense of what goals the administration would like to see coming out of tomorrow?
Sure. First of all, it's the first Camp David kind of summit. It's called the Camp David Principles. Not only the first time that he's had the foreign leaders up there, but it's also the first time actually just for the three leaders, not on the side of a G7 meeting or on the side of a NATO meeting, but to meet as three leaders for the purpose. So this is inaugural. One of the outgrowths of this is going to be, there's going to be an annual meeting. So it's not going to be driven by events. It's not going to be driven when the schedule works, but it's going to be driven for the purpose of the three countries coming together, meeting and making that a new norm, so to say. Second is, you talked earlier in the introduction about security. There will be pieces on, obviously, intelligence sharing, on integrating on certain systems and more coordination and making them seamless. There'll be annual planning for military exercises, trilateral, and then the execution of those across multiple dimensions and skill set. All that is one level of deterrence. There'll also be greater coordination on cybersecurity, economic coordination, supply chain, energy, healthcare. So there's a big, robust piece of this that will be on the political front, the security front, and the economic front.
I mean, concerns over China's role in the Indo-Pacific region will obviously be a main topic. What specifically are the concerns of the Japanese and the South Koreans with regards to China?
Well, both countries, starting in 2010 for Japan and 2017 for Korea, both have been victims of China's a very aggressive economic coercion. That has happened to the Philippines. That has happened also to Australia. So both have been victims and targeted and had economic coercion applied to them. In the Senkaku Islands for Japan, regularly intervention in the for Japan by Chinese ships. When Nancy Pelosi's trip was done, China did a series of activities around Taiwan, and they threw five missiles into Japan's EEZ. There's a series of other things they've done as it relates to Korea. So both have, both on military level, security level, cyber attacks, economic areas, have been a target of China's aggression. I mean, let me just say this. When you look at India on their border, you look at the Philippines recently on the Thomas Shoals, China's not going to win this year the Good Neighbor Policy Award. And everybody in that region has been in one way or another targeted militarily, targeted economically, targeted on economic coercion, targeted for in their own security areas or economic areas and their own geographic areas.
Is there any concern that you're hearing from your allies, from your colleagues, that while the Biden administration could enter into these agreements, the next administration, which could be a second Trump administration, can just undo them? Isn't that a real concern?
It's not about that. It's to ensure that there's a new normal. There's a new standard. It's embedded into, for lack of a better way of saying it, it's embedded into the DNA of all our institutions in all three countries. You have to give kudos to Prime Minister Kishida, President Yoon, for the courage they have shown in kind of leaning into this against some political headwinds. President Biden, to think about this, you know, 6 weeks ago he was in Vilnius, Lithuania, brings Sweden and Finland into the NATO family. 6 weeks later, at Camp David, he's bringing Japan and Korea into the kind of strategic formulation. Both are major diplomatic efforts. And the goal is to actually see we have more in common. I think everybody realizes future generations shouldn't have to spend political capital. Let's get this to the higher level, lock it in, lock it down, and run up the score. And that's what this is about.
But there isn't any concern that, however substantive tomorrow is, that a subsequent administration could undo them if they wanted.
That's true for all the countries. So the goal here is to make sure that it's so wedded and so embedded where you're spending time, you're spending money, you're spending resources, that it becomes the new norm. And I think both, I don't want to speak for them, they're the heads of state, that's a question you can ask them. But I think everybody acknowledges they don't want future prime ministers, future presidents of either Korea or the United States to spend the political capital to get to this. I can tell you, having worked for two other presidents, both Democrats and Republican presidents would want to be where President Biden is. A lot of administrations have worked towards this. This is an amazing accomplishment because it reorders not only the three countries, but most importantly, it is a new fact on the ground in the Indo-Pacific. There's a risk for everything like that, but for all three countries, that's why all three leaders are determined to literally get this woven into the kind of grain of the wood of the institutions, whether that's on the military side, the intelligence side, the defense side, the training side, the economic security side, the supply chain side. That is to make sure that it's on, for all three countries, a fact.
Ambassador Rahm Emanuel, U.S. Ambassador to Japan, thank you so much for being here.
Thank you, William.
It was the largest mass killing in Egypt's modern history. 10 years ago this week, Egyptian soldiers overran a protest camp in Cairo's Rabah Square, killing hundreds. 6 weeks earlier, the military had overthrown the elected government of Mohamed Morsi and the Muslim Brotherhood, and supporters of the ousted government had created a protest city in Rabah. Its destruction still reverberates in today's Egypt. Nick Schifrin looks back.
Just after dawn, chaos. Live fire flew through one of Cairo's busiest squares. For 12 hours, Egyptian forces besieged Rabah. They bulldozed homemade barricades. Snipers fired from nearby rooftops. The aftermath, a scorched square. A camp turned into a carcass. And mosques converted to morgues. The government death toll was 624. Human Rights Watch says the real count was likely at least 1,000. Rabah had become a tent city. Tens of thousands built a self-sustaining protest with their own kitchens, water distribution, and administration that ran 24/7 for more than 45 days. They demanded the reinstatement of Mohamed Morsi, Muslim Brotherhood leader who became Egypt's first democratically elected president after the 2011 revolution that deposed Hosni Mubarak. And they protested then-General Abdel Fattah el-Sisi, who in early July 2013 had seized power. Sisi became president a year later in 2014 in elections that independent observers called unfair. He would later change the constitution to remain president potentially past 2030. Today, Rabah is quiet. The anniversary was not marked. Nobody was ever held accountable. In Sisi's Egypt, there is no room for memorializing massacre. Since 2013, the government has imprisoned more than 60,000 Egyptians, from liberal activists to anyone connected to the Muslim Brotherhood. 10 years ago was a turning point, proving the military was willing to use force to cement its hold on power.
And that hold on power remains as strong now as it was 10 years ago. For more, we turn to our own Jane Ferguson, who was in Cairo that day and covered the Rabah massacre, and Hossam Bagat, an Egyptian human rights activist and founder of the Egyptian Initiative for Personal Rights based in Cairo. Thanks very much, both of you. Jane, take us back to that day. What did you see?
It began early in the morning, Nick. You had massive units of the Egyptian security forces go in and simply start opening fire. Now, myself and my team were at one of the exit and entrance points of the Rabah Square soon afterwards, as soon as we rushed there. And we saw people being pulled out, those with massive gunshot wounds, and just utter scenes of chaos as people were trying to flee. And eventually we made our way, by simply following the crowds to various places where the bodies were being taken. And what we found when we entered a mosque was that it was filled with an increasing number of bodies of those who had been shot by their own government.
One of the main challenges for those simply trying to organize this amount of bodies and process them is trying to keep the bodies from decomposing. Here now, they've started bringing in bags of ice as an emergency scenario, placing them on top of the bodies to try to keep them from decaying.
Those were really shocking scenes at the time. It's important to remember that this is believed to have been one of the biggest ever single events of demonstrators or protesters being shot dead in the street in modern history. And in the following days and weeks, because what happened was an increasing crackdown on protesters, Morsi supporters, and journalists.
And that crackdown, as you said, Jane, continued to journalists. How did the government make clear they were willing to prosecute journalists? And how does that willingness continue to this day?
Well, shortly afterwards, it was as resistance kept continuing and small protests were popping up, the Egyptian authorities actually arrested largely the entire bureau of the Al Jazeera English team at the time, which included an Australian journalist, Peter Greste. Him and his team and his bureau chief, Mohamed Fahmy, they were arrested and sent to jail and effectively spent over a year in an Egyptian jail. That was a message to news organizations, to international news organizations, Americans, Europeans, that sending journalists to Egypt to investigate and report on human rights would be extremely dangerous. And what we've seen over the last decade is that that has worked.
Hossam Bagat, how was Rabah a turning point for Egypt?
It was a turning point in many different ways. It was basically not just the end of the promise of the Egyptian revolution of 2011, but really the end of our country as we know it. Egypt was never really, you know, a liberal democracy. It was always a country with a problematic human rights record and serious areas of concerns. But what we saw following Rabah is just rule by one military leader who established a dictatorship that not just imprisoned all government critics, but for the first time in Egyptian modern history, eviscerated civic space altogether. So we have been ruled for the last 10 years without opposition parties, without critical media, without independent courts or really parliamentary oversight, without any space for civil society, and with zero room for dissent and zero public demonstrations.
Was there ever any justice for what happened in Rabah?
The only way to describe it is the opposite of justice. It's been 10 years with, you know, according to government figures, at least 600, 80 maybe killed, thousands injured. And the only people that have been arrested and prosecuted since then are the survivors of those massacres. There was one official inquiry conducted that the government allowed and was sort of forced into 10 years ago. That inquiry produced a report that was submitted to the president, yet the report of that fact-finding commission was never published until really this week, when we made excerpts of it public for the very first time. And, surprisingly, of course, the conclusions of that inquiry that were never made public almost to a large extent match the conclusions of independent journalists, of independent civil society investigations, which is that the government knew at a very high level that there is going to be a high human toll of casualties, that the shooting was indiscriminate. It was disproportionate with the threat that these security forces faced from only a handful of armed elements. And most importantly, that the vast majority of those killed, that they were peaceful protesters, as opposed to the government's false narrative for the last 10 years that they had to open fire at armed elements among protesters.
And finally, Jane Ferguson, in the time we have left, you have reported so much from across the region. Put this in perspective for us. What is the legacy of Rabah and all the changes in Egypt that we've just been discussing on North Africa and the Middle East?
We've really got to look, Nick, back at 2013 as a year of something of a crisis in American foreign policy in the Middle East and in the Arab world. Of course, at the time, you had the Obama government the Obama administration, which had, whenever you had the coup happen, they would not use the word coup. They condemned any of the violence that happened as a result of this massacre. Of course, in the same year, we also had the famous red line in Syria, where the Obama administration administration had said if the Assad regime uses chemical weapons on their own people, they would be willing to act militarily. And that red line was crossed, and there wasn't really any military response from the United States. It was in that moment that I think a lot of people in the region look back and will say this is when United States policy was in something of a crisis, whereby U.S. withdrawal from the Middle East was happening at a time when people were being massacred by their own governments. And the last 10 years has seen an extraordinary amount of violence against civilians, of human rights abuses across the Middle East, and a real backlash against those heady, hopeful Arab Spring days.
R. Jane Ferguson, Hossam Bhaghat, thank you very much to you both.
Thank you.
In the midst of the pandemic, a woman tells her three grown daughters a story of her youth, about a love affair, a path that she might have taken, but didn't. They, in turn, tell her of their hopes for fears for the future. Tom Lake is the latest novel by renowned writer Ann Patchett, who also owns an independent bookstore in Nashville, Tennessee. Jeffrey Brown joined her in New Hampshire recently for our arts and culture series, Canvas.
It's cool. Wow.
Ann Patchett's novel, Tom Lake, begins in a high school in a small New Hampshire town when a young girl named Laura makes a sudden life-changing decision to audition for a role in a play.
She is not there to try out for the role of Emily. She's there to register the people who have come to try out for the play. Mm-hmm. And they're so bad that she decides after 4 hours of listening to auditions that she's just going to get up and read the lines in a straightforward way because she loves the play.
Yes, we all know in our bones that there is something eternal about every human being.
The play is Thornton Wilder's 1938 classic, Our Town, seen here in a 2003 production starring Paul Newman. It's a deceptively simple portrait of the everyday, what we see and what we miss, and the quick passing of a life.
Goodbye, world. Goodbye, Grover's Corners.
And it's a play that Patchett, like her fictional character, has always loved.
It's about paying attention to all of the small moments of your life, realizing that your life really is just the compilation of small moments, and either you are awake to them and pay attention to them, or you're always looking ahead and you miss your life.
So that becomes, of course, the theme, or one of the themes of Tom Lake.
Yes, yes. Tom Lake definitely started with Our Town. Somebody said to me recently, so how did you decide which play Laura is going to be in high school? And I was like, oh, no. I started with Our Town and then figured out who the characters were.
Wilder based his fictional town of Grover's Corners on the real-life New Hampshire town of Peterborough, where he also produced it with the Peterborough Players, a professional summer stock theater. He'd conceived and written part of it in a small cabin at McDowell, the famed artist residency program in Peterborough. And that's where we met Patchett, who'd herself once had a residency here, to talk about a novel in which Laura, now an adult, tells her three grown daughters the story of her long-ago summer romance with a young man who would become a world-famous actor.
She's not going to tell her daughters the whole story, but nobody ever tells anybody the whole story. I mean, we all edit our stories based on our audience. I'm going to tell a story to my husband one way, to my best friend one way, to you one way. It's not that you're lying. It's just that you shape your story to fit your audience.
But, I mean, that suggests we all have many stories.
Of course. Everyone. What are we except a bunch of stories, a compilation of the stories that we've lived and that we've told ourselves and other people over the course of our lives.
Now 59, Patchett has been telling stories for a long time, with 9 novels, 15 books in all. One of our best-selling and best-loved writers. But there's always something new to learn.
It was actually really a joy to write this book. And you want to know why?
Yeah.
I wrote the entire book on a treadmill.
What do you mean? Like, literally, while you were...
Yeah.
Yeah?
I got a treadmill desk.
Yeah.
I wrote the whole book on a treadmill desk. So I walked the whole book. And for whatever reason, it just thrilled me. I would get up in the morning and think, I'm ready to go to work. I'm going to go get on the treadmill desk. I'm going to go write my book. And I've never felt that way before. It was a joy.
There is much joy in this novel, set mostly on a cherry farm in Michigan, where Laura has made her life far from any one-time dream of the glamour of Hollywood, and is herself coming to see what a life is made of, as in this passage.
There is no explaining this simple truth about life. You will forget much of it. The painful things you'd be certain you would never be able to let go of, now you're not entirely sure when they happened, while the thrilling parts, the heart-stopping joys, splintered and scattered and became something else. Memories are then replaced by different joys and larger sorrows, and unbelievably, those things get knocked aside as well.
But this is also set amid the pandemic, and Laura's daughters bring their own fears for their lives into the story.
One of the things that this book is about, but I am so struck by, is when I was in my 20s, I worried if I had enough money to go out to dinner. You know, we'll go to the matinee because we don't have enough money to go at night. We'll go to the restaurant, but we'll just get a piece of pie. I really want to get this story written. Maybe I'll send this story to a magazine. That's what I was worried about. At the bookstore, that I own a bookstore in Nashville, Parnassus. We have all these employees, a lot of them in their 20s and 30s. And that's not what they're worried about. I mean, they're worried about the pandemic. They're worried about climate change. They're worried about gerrymandering. They're worried about the right to love who you love. I mean, it's the weight of the things that young people have to worry about today is so different from the things that I worried about when I was young.
Here you say it, the beauty and the suffering are equally true.
Right. That's exactly right. There's a lot to feel terrible about, but there is also so much joy, and there's so much to feel good about, and you can hold those two opposite things. We all do every single day. We hold those opposite truths.
That's true for the world of books as well. Patchett is a champion of writers and literature generally, but is also near the front lines of today's battles over book bans.
Things aren't great in Tennessee. The people who are banning books don't care about books. You don't ever ban something you care about. You want to keep kids safe, ban guns. You want to keep kids safe, maybe don't let them bring their phones into school. But nobody is going to keep a child safe by keeping a book from them. And yet by making the conversation about the book, then no one on either side has the energy to talk about the things that really matter. Schools really matter. Teachers, librarians really matter.
For all her character's uncertainties and those of our times, Ann Patchett has always had her own clarity. And nothing brings it out like being back in high school.
Did you know what you wanted to be when you were in high school?
Yeah.
You did?
I did. I wanted to be a writer.
Yeah.
I wanted to be a writer. I never wanted to be anything else in my life.
How did you have that certainty?
I have no idea. But if you were interviewing 6-year-old Ann Patchett on this stage right now and said, Ann, what do you want to do with your life? I would have said, Jeff, I want to be a writer.
For the PBS NewsHour, I'm Jeffrey Brown in Our Town, Peterborough, New Hampshire.
And we'll be back shortly with a profile of one of the great women scientists of the 20th century. But first, take a moment to hear from your local PBS station. It's a chance to offer your support, which helps keep programs like ours on the air. For those of you staying with us, Leanne Morgan is finding comedy in the chaos of marriage and motherhood. She's a storyteller who draws on her experience growing up in rural Tennessee, being married for over 30 years, raising 3 kids, and becoming a grandmother. Morgan sat down with Jeff Bennett in this reprise from our arts and culture series, Canvas.
When my boy and his wife found out about this precious baby, they would say, their baby. And we would say, our baby. And then they started using words like boundaries.
Now at 57 years old, Leanne Morgan's stand-up career is taking off, and she's just released her first Netflix stand-up special.
They're going to have this precious baby, and they're going to be up all night, and that's going to go into weeks and months, and then my little daughter-in-law is going to start hallucinating. And then she's going to wake up in the night, and she'll be breastfeeding a lamp. And we'll see who's got boundaries.
I sat down with her in New York City to talk about her unconventional comedy career.
Most comedians get their starts in comedy clubs or in writers' rooms. You found your way to professional stand-up by selling jewelry, is that right?
Yes, my darling. Okay, so my husband and I met at the University of Tennessee. And when we graduated, he bought a used mobile home business where he refurbished mobile homes and sold them. And he moved me to Bean Station, Tennessee, in the foothills of the Appalachian Mountains, and I start selling jewelry.
And you're going house to house doing this?
I'm going house to house at night. My husband took care of the baby, and then I was supposed to be talking about jewelry, and I schlepped this big jewelry case around, and I didn't talk about jewelry. I talked about breastfeeding and hemorrhoids, and I developed a shtick, really, an act, and women thought I was funny and started booking me about a year in advance.
Wow.
And that gave me the confidence. People would say, you need to be a stand-up.
Is that what you wanted for yourself? Did you want to be a stand-up comedian?
I wanted to be in show business, and I thought I was funny, and I always loved comedy, but I didn't know what that, you know, what it would end up. But stand-up, I knew I could tell a story.
Ladies and gentlemen, Leanne Morgan!
After two decades on stage, Leanne's first special on YouTube has more than 50 million views. Her new Netflix special reached the top 10.
My husband and I met, and I was so cute. And I was little, I had on little britches, and my thyroid was functioning. And now, I truly believe he would not pull me out of a burning vehicle.
Your family provides fodder for so much of your act. How do they feel about that?
They feel fine about it now. Mm-hmm. When they were in middle school, my children said, do not speak my name. And they also said, don't come up to this school with yoga pants on. So that was a dry time for me. And my husband only one time has said to me, don't say that again. I said something about I wanted something, but it was a bad mobile home year. Uh-huh. And he said, I've always provided for you. Do not say that again. And it hurt me for him. And I've never said anything like that again. But he doesn't care about anything else.
Leanne's act is relatable and a reflection of her life. Comedy with a common touch.
I've done every diet in the world. My mama and my sister and I took Dexatrim. Do y'all remember Dexatrim? Yeah. It was speed. We took speed as a family. They sold it on the shelves everywhere. We were all taking dope. I mean, that's funny how things resonate with people, because I've had more comments of people saying, oh my gosh, my mom and I took Dexatrim together.
I'm out here on the porch, and I'm looking rough.
When COVID hit, Leanne was about to start a 100-city tour, and like many others, leaned into social media and cooking.
You just mix all that together and you just chill it, and it's really good.
I started talking about my recipes and taking care of my little mom and daddy. They needed me and what I was feeding them and my family. And it grew more than I ever thought it would. So that was a helpful thing. As horrible as all that was, I think it helped grow my audience because people were at home.
Yeah, and it gave them a point of connection.
And people started making all this Jell-O all over the United States. And I know Jell-O is very divisive.
It's controversial. That's
it's
right.
Very controversial. But where I'm from, in the middle Tennessee, we love a good gelatin salad. You know, with a little pineapple, a pecan, little cottage cheese or cream cheese, little Cool Whip.
Wow. Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I know.
That's way beyond.
I know.
That's beyond the Jell-O.
I know.
I'm used to.
I don't want to worry you, but to us, that's a big. It's nice to take to a church supper.
The thing I really loved about your act is that there's no underlying political or social message. It really is just about the laughs. It's about finding the funny moments in family and growing older.
And I understand how people want to do that and, you know, do the comedy that way. But I just never written that way or ever thought that way. Plus, I thought, nobody cares what I think. And I don't, I want it to be fun. I don't want anybody to feel uncomfortable. But yeah, that's how I don't write that way, you know. I probably don't read enough, Jeff, to know what's going on.
Leanne says this run of success could not have happened at a better time. She just signed on to star in a Will Ferrell and Reese Witherspoon comedy. And she's back on the road on a national stand-up tour this summer.
The tour is called Just Getting Started. Is that how it feels?
Yes, Jeff. Okay, when you're from the country like I am, you know, we're meemaws. We like to start cooking pinto beans and wearing house dresses.
Right.
And I thought, I'm just going to bow out of this thing. And then this happened.
Yeah.
When I look back on it, because I've had television deals for sitcoms. Mm-hmm. I've had four deals. And they wouldn't make it. My children were little. And I'd be devastated. And I look back on it now and I think, oh my gosh, that was not the right time. I got to raise these children in Knoxville, Tennessee. And then now, they don't need me like they used to. They still need me. And then this happened to me at this time in my life. And I'm having a ball. And it's bigger and more wonderful and more special than anything I ever dreamed of.
Qian Sheng Wu is not likely a household name, but she is among the great scientists of the 20th century. For PBS News Weekend, John Yang explored her remarkable career, whose contributions to the field of physics have often been overlooked.
Over the course of her trailblazing career, Qian Sheng Wu was known by a number of monikers: the First Lady of Physics, the Queen of Nuclear Research, the Chinese Marie Curie. She was one of the most influential physicists of the 20th century. Her work helped hasten the end of the Second World War and changed our understanding of subatomic particles. At a time when it was rare to educate girls in China, she studied physics at National Central University in what is now Nanjing, graduating at the top of her class. With the financial support of an uncle, Wu came to the United States and in 1940 earned her PhD at the University of California, Berkeley. She couldn't find a research position at a university, so became a teacher. She was the first woman in Princeton University's physics department. In 1944, she was asked to join the faculty of Columbia University to become a senior scientist on the top-secret Manhattan Project, the government's World War II effort to develop an atomic weapon. Her work primarily involved uranium enrichment and radiation detection. Columbia, where she worked until retiring in 1980, was the site of her most significant work. In 1956, theoretical physicists Zhengdao Li and Chenning Yang asked her to come up with a way to test their theory on the behavior of subatomic particles. The results of her ingenious method, known as the Wu experiment, shattered a fundamental concept of nuclear physics that had been universally accepted for 30 years. Li and Yang were awarded the 1957 Nobel Prize in Physics, but Wu, like many women scientists of her day, was left out. In a speech at MIT in 1964, she asked whether the tiny atoms and nuclei, or the mathematical symbols, or the DNA molecules have any preference for either masculine or feminine treatment. Her 1965 book, Beta Decay, is still considered standard reading for nuclear physicists. While her work wasn't recognized for the Nobel Prize, she earned many other honors, including the National Medal of Science in 1975 and the first Wolf Prize in Physics in 1978. And in 2021, 24 years after her death in 1997, Wu was honored with a U.S. postage stamp. For the PBS NewsHour, I'm John Yang.
You can find more of our Hidden History series on our website, pbs.org/newshour. And that's the NewsHour for tonight. Remember, there is a lot more online, including a look at who the top candidates are in the Republican field ahead of the first GOP primary debate next week. That's all on our YouTube page. I'm William Brangham. Thanks for spending part of your evening with us. Good night.